Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. We have a treat today. Our guest is Richard Bausch, the acclaimed novelist and short story writer, who currently has in the bookstores Wives and Lovers, three short novels, which was published by Perennial. The stories of Richard Bausch, a wonderful collection of, I believe, 42 of Mr. Bausch's stories published by HarperCollins. And we're also going to talk about Hello to the Cannibals, a novel Mr. Bausch wrote, which is available in Perennial and is also available in hardcover. And all of Mr. Bausch's works are available in very nice trade paperbacks, so I urge you to go to the bookstores and read all of them. We're also joined this morning with Amanda Bausch and Maggie Bausch, Mr. Bausch's daughters, and Claudia Shapiro, who is Joe McCorkle's daughter. So we have an audience today for the radio show, so we can just let everybody out there know that it's not just the two of us sitting here in this room. First of all, good morning, and thank you for appearing on the Casey Kowar Show.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. My pleasure.
The three short novels features the first novel is a new unpublished novel, Requisite Kindness. It's a story of a family who returns home to deal with a loss. And I thought it was a brilliant story of how families try to cope with such a devastating loss in the midst of their problems and how they're trying to pass it off and blame it on someone. So what was when you were writing Requisite Kindness, when did it go from being a story to a novel?
I think it started out pretty much as a, I knew it was going to be long. I didn't know that it was going to be too short to be published alone. But I knew it was not going to be done inside 50 or 60 pages just because of the material, which is in fact, I was originally calling it Rare and Endangered Species, and the second novella in the book is called Rare and Endangered Species. And I put Requisite Kindness aside and wrote Rare and Endangered Species, and then years later, this Requisite Kindness was written only about 2 years ago, 3 years ago. Picked it up again and wrote it, and I had this. The idea for me was what does this man do? His whole life has seen women as objects. If he is forced into having to be the nurturer, the one guiding his, you know, aging mother into death, that the two of them are alone in a snowstorm. And from that, the whole story came out, then the sons and everything. And I realized I could only tell it by showing first the funeral and then going back to the death.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's the son who is not forced, but kind of, in a sense, locked into the house with his mother is, I found, a very fascinating character, because oftentimes we do have the sister or the daughter or the mother is providing that caregiving, and this guy is kind of clueless at first in terms of what he's really supposed to do and how difficult a role it is, and some of those decisions in terms of dealing with mortality,
yeah,
his own as well as hers.
Yeah.
Now we're going to talk about a novel which, when I read it, I told Mr. Bausch, when I saw him 2 days ago here at the University of the South, that as a writer I was kind of physically tired when I finished Hello to the Cannibals, not by reading the novel, but just thinking of how much work went into this book. And if you've not read Hello to the Cannibals, I urge you to finish listening to this show, but then go get the book. Because, in essence, what Mr. Bausch has done is written three books. He's written a biography, a drama, a dramatic story, a novel, and a play, all at the same time. And somehow he manages to pull this off, moving in and out of time from dealing with the biography, really, of Mary Kingsley, who actually walked this earth, and then modern day characters who are dealing with their own struggles. And one of the characters finds herself drawn to Mary Kingsley. And if you would tell me, Mary Kingsley, which came first? Was it the interest in Mary Kingsley, or was it the interest in the characters in the novel?
No, I'd always entertained a fondness for Mary Kingsley. I didn't know much more about her than what Evan S. Cannell wrote about her in the Aztec Treasure House, talking about explorers. It's actually anthologized in a book of his called The Long Desire, which is a wonderful book. And so I carried that around for years, really 20 years, and didn't really know much more about her, though I'd bring her up sometimes talking to people who would make assumptions about how life was for women in the 19th century, and I'd say, well, not all women were the same way, everybody's different. And but then I was writing a novel, I thought, about a long friendship between a young woman who, when you first see her, is getting ready to graduate from the University of Virginia and gets married to someone who really, although she's, you know, he's gorgeous and she loves him, is not up to her in terms of intelligence and or sensibility either. And was going to be a story of a long friendship between her and a friend who was homosexual named Dominic. And I was about, I don't know, 30 or 40 pages into it. And I was talking to a dear friend of mine in his basement that had just been refinished, and I'm sitting there, and we got to talking about explorers and books, and I mentioned Mary Kingsley, and then it just struck me that, wait a minute, I could have Mary Kingsley, I could talk about one woman at the end of one century and another woman at the end of this century. And so I thought about it, and then I sort of forgot about it for a few days, and then Mary Kingsley just sort of walked into it and wouldn't leave, and it turned out to be a tremendous amount of fun, even though it was also agonizing and a whole lot of work, because I didn't know really much of anything about Victorian era or Mary Kingsley. So I read all the biographies I could get of her. There's three, and I read a novel about her, which was a little scary because I didn't want to infringe on that territory, even though the woman who wrote it died a long time ago. Good novel, though, called This Is Your Home. And then I read Mary Kingsley's books, and then books, just general books about the Victorians, what kinds of, and books about Africa, because I'd never, and I didn't go to Africa, and I didn't go to England. I've still never been there. So I had to rent, or Paris, so I had to sort of render those places by just looking at a lot of paintings and pictures and stuff.
Yeah, I was thinking when Mary Kingsley goes into Africa, it probably would have been irrelevant if you really would have been particular about geography, because the countries have changed so often since she traveled, and really from year to year and decade to decade, it would be hard to pin down exactly where she might have been. But one of the most creative parts of the book I found was when she really gets into the wilds of Africa and encounters some of the tribes.
Yeah, that's still pretty wild down there between the Igalwa River and the Congo. It's still pretty, because the country itself, that area, West Africa, and that coast, the coastal areas, is just singularly uninhabitable. I mean, people do inhabit it, but it's really a testimony to their ingenuity, because nature is always pulling it down, pulling it away, because it's hotter than it ever gets anywhere on Earth. There's several dozen kinds of things that kill you.
And she's always wearing a large dress. I don't know what you would...
Just as if she was in a parlor in a Victorian.
And one of the things that I liked about Mary Kingsley and about your writing about her was there's a clear line of demarcation that she is not a missionary in Africa. She is there as an explorer and one who accepts the tribes and the people she meets without trying to convert them to any type of religion. So consequently, she is treated better by the people, and she's accepted and has a much better experience than the missionaries that went there, and a lot of them did not come back because they were not wanted there.
No, and in fact, she really didn't like them. I mean, she met a couple that she really got along with because she could see they were trying to help rather than proselytize. But she really got along best and felt the most trustworthy people down there were the traders, because they respected the people they were trading with, and they understood that they were shrewd and in their own way, and that their culture was just different.
And their motives were pure. The traders, their motives were pure. It was clear what they were trying to do, and the tribal people could understand that. One of the things I'd like to tell the audience is that Hello to the Cannibals, do not let that title put you off, okay, because the role of cannibalism is very minor, actually, in the story, but it's very effective when when it's talked about. But I think maybe at first people might look at Hello to the Cannibals and say, what is, you know, what am I getting into? And let me assure you that there are no scenes in the book which are going to be difficult for a reader or a writer to read. And so do not fear the cannibals.
Well, and actually the title for me is like a, it's a sort of a metaphor. The book's really about bravery, the different kinds of bravery in women. Mary's bravery is inward and toward intimacy. She's just, but not Mary, Lily, the modern character. She's interested in Mary because Mary was an intrepid explorer and her bravery was outward. She went out and climbed mountains and stuff and went to places nobody, no European had ever been. But Mary, all her life, was running away from intimacy after her parents died when she was 30. That's the active year she had in the world from 30 to 37 before she died of fever. She was running away from intimacy and she was terrified of it. But she was so brave in all these other ways. So the two kinds of bravery started to really fascinate me. And there's a line in the book that says, you know, the exploration of another human soul. Another human soul is also a wilderness, and the exploration of that requires courage, too. And
I remember that line.
Yeah. So for me, the whole idea of Hello to the Cannibals is that the way you live in the world, though it's a terrifying place sometimes, and there's a whole lot of things to that can harm you and all the rest, is that the way you live fully is to go out in the world and say hello to the cannibals and see what happens, you know, because really that's what she did. She would go in, the villagers called her Only Me, because she would just go in and say, hello, it's Only Me, and set up a tea table and want to talk to them, and they just didn't know what to make of her. But they grew to, they loved her blonde hair. They would come up and touch it and stare at her, and they loved her way of learning their languages so quickly and her respect for them. She just had deep respect for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so they allowed her to take their picture, which was just unheard of. And they gave her all sorts of jujus and fetish things to take home with her.
Did any of the pictures survive?
Yeah,
did many of them?
There are some in her travels in West Africa, which I highly recommend. It's I don't know of another travel book any better than that one. I mean, it's just so much fun to read.
Well, there's another bonus for the listeners, a good travel book on top of a wonderful novel. Let's go back to the modern day protagonist in Hello to the Cannibals, Lily. And one of the themes, I think, of any great novel is the motivation of the characters. And I know that here at the University of the South, at the Sewanee Writers Conference, that for a writer, one of the hardest things is to create characters that are compelling and interesting and what motivates them. And by itself, Lily's journey with Dominic is a very fascinating story, and I'm not going to give that away to the audience. But the motivations of childbirth and family and in the 21st century, how we define family, has really kind of come unglued, and the traditional family is almost a rarity. It's almost a tribe of its own now, much as Mary Kingsley encountered down in Africa. And when you were writing the scenes that we're talking about, was there a point where you said, this is going to be very difficult to maintain the motivation of the characters here when some of these secrets are revealed? But it's very believable, so.
Yeah, when the secrets get revealed, that's what, for me, became the engine. So that, you know, they're in this tangle, and they're trying to untangle it some way, and they still love each other. And they're trying to figure it, trying to find some way to... I mean, there's a tremendous amount of anger on her husband, whose name is Tyler, on his part. And he's immature and unable to handle it. This is a situation, as somebody once said about Othello, he's presented with, for which he's totally unprepared, has no experience in life to turn to and look at and say, well, it's like that, so maybe I can do this. It's completely unexplored ground for him. And I do mean unexplored in the sense of exploration, which is what the book is really, you know, talking about. And his failure really doesn't have to do with how he feels. He still loves Lily. He's still in love with her. But there's this rage. And that he has to contend with. And then there's her essential honesty as a person and her feeling that it would be poison everything if she, you know, she continues in the way she is without revealing everything. And so that tension then provided the engine, and it became much, much less of a trouble trying to figure it all out. Once you have the real trouble visited upon your characters, and then you're just riding along to see how they respond to it, then it's a lot of fun.
So there was a point where all the characters started talking to each other, and you were just kind of driving the car
just
and letting them
around.
Yeah. Our guest today is Richard Bausch. We're talking about Hello to the Cannibals, and we're also talking about Wives and Lovers and the stories of Richard Bausch. This is the Casey Kohar Show. Stay right where you are. We'll be right back. This is the Casey Kohar Show, a celebration of words. Our guest today is Richard Bausch, and I'm delighted to have Mr. Bausch on our show, and we're talking about Hello to the Cannibals. And this is a book that I urge all of you to go out and buy it and read it, and you will understand all of the things that Mr. Bausch and I are discussing this morning. And it will also be an entree into the world of Richard Bausch, which you'll be treated with novels, novellas, I know that's a dirty word, and stories. And I'd like to say what Richard Ford said about the stories of Richard Bausch. And this is a quote from Richard Ford. He says, "In the small firmament of American writers who are both superb novelists and eloquent short story practitioners, Richard Bausch's star shines more brightly now than ever," unquote. That's pretty high praise from Richard Ford, a pretty good writer himself. And that, I want to talk about your stories in a minute, but back to Hello to the Cannibals. One of the subjects that you deal with is in the case of Lily, Tyler, and Dominic, and also Mary Kingsley, is people that just pick up and go. And that is one way of dealing with intimacy, is just to completely avoid it and to run away. And you could have done it when Mary Kingsley was alive. She could have bolted on her father who was sick and her mother who was sick and just taken off. But she didn't. Perhaps she might have in the world we live in today. She might have stuck them in an assisted living facility and hit the road. But she was not of that era nor that ilk. And so in the modern characters, some of them do choose to cut and run.
Yeah. The Lily and Tyler going down to where Tyler's mother lives. Tyler was abandoned by his mother when he was 5. She took the daughter and left the son with Tyler's father. And Tyler wants to know her, and he has this invitation from his stepfather to come work for him. But Tyler, before it's all over with, does just that. In fact, he entertains for a while, he claims, the idea of killing himself. But he cuts and runs and then tells Lily he forgives her. Lily writes back that, you know, he makes it sound as if that the whole thing was a toothache. But I think that I wasn't really thinking consciously about the family formations that go on. But it ends up being a household, you know, Lily and her friend Dominic and the baby and Dominic's friend Manny and Manny's elderly aunt, Violet, who I had a great deal of fun writing about. But all of it was, I didn't know any of that was going to be there until it came there, and then I had to try to make it, you know, as clear as I could make it.
And you did a wonderful job on that. One of the things that amazed me in the novel was I never felt out of place or out of time or where am I now, and which is an amazing feat. Because let's talk about the play for a moment. There's a play that Lily writes. Her parents are in the theater and are very successful. And if she really wants to, she can kind of scam off of her father's name if she would so choose. And I, being a person that probably would have done that, If my last name was famous, I probably would have taken that route when I was 18 or 19 or 20. Unfortunately, that was not my lot, but she's very adamant that she's not going to use the influence of her parents to create her art in her play. So tell me a little bit about the play itself and how that came about. And had you ever written a play before?
No. I wrote one play and took it to a friend. I was 23, and it was a tragedy, you know, because I had read Eugene O'Neill. And
you were 23.
And I was 23. And he started laughing really hard on about the third page. And I said, well, what the hell are you laughing at? And he said, this is terrible. And this is before the days of environmental consciousness. I threw the whole thing out the window of this house on the third floor of this house, and the pages just settled on the lawn like snow.
You'd be arrested now.
Yeah. Well, I'd be guilty now, too. I don't feel guilty for it then because the consciousness was different. It was just paper. But anyway, Lily's a playwright. One of the things about it, I had a scene where Lily's friend, who is her husband's half-sister, says to her, but this is prose that you're writing here. This isn't a play. And I thought it would be too blatant and kind of tricky and gimmicky kind of stuff, so I let it go. But in my mind, the prose sections about Mary are really Lily's creation, and they're her working out of things to make the play. And then the plays, the snippets of the play that you see are her attempts to actually transmute it into the play. By doing that and by having that, I don't think it's utterly necessary that the reader perceive that Mary's writing those prose sections. That Lily is. At all. I mean, fiction, you can go anywhere with it, you know? It sort of irked me when I heard, I don't read reviews anymore, but it irked me when I heard that some reviewers were saying that, you know, it just wasn't believable that there could be this relationship, you know, across time. And I'm thinking, well, yeah, okay, all right.
Use your imagination. It's called fiction.
Yeah, it's like it's my idea, my job to produce the real, actual, terrible world, you know, with the dentist office and all the magazines stacked up. And, the upshot of the whole thing was that I thought I needed to have those little sections of Lily's play so that you could see she was proceeding and working on it. And also I could deal with some matters of Mary's life that would then not require page upon indefatigable page of prose if I could suggest it in the play, you know. And it worked, and I was happy with it. I liked the look of it. And I liked the fact that nobody that I know of is quite mention this, that the book is really a rather radical experiment in narrative structure, because there's a whole lot of different ways this story gets told. There's letters, there's journal entries and stuff. And it is going, moving, you know, back and forth from 100 years forward.
Yeah, I found it totally believable and totally compelling. And was your editor of help in any of this?
Oh, yeah. Oh my.
Who was your editor?
Yes, Dan Conaway. At HarperCollins. He's amazing. Truly a great reader.
And tell us, if you would, because one of the goals of my show is to educate the audience on the process of publication as well, and how a book comes to your bookstore and to you through the mail. And there's a person called the editor along the way, and the good ones are... put a tremendous amount of effort into shaping an author's work for very little public recognition, and to me they're the true heroes of the literary world because their motives are pure, which is almost impossible to find in the world of books these days.
Yeah, well, he takes such a passionate and he's so passionately involved in the books that he's doing, and with this book he inherited it. My editor, Robert Jones, who was also an amazing, great guy, a friend, and Conaway has since become a friend like that. But Robert Jones died in 2001, and in fact, I was at a memorial service for him the day before the September 11th attacks.
Wow.
So I was in New York when it happened. But I first went with another guy for a little while. I mean, I was... given this other guy, and I was up there to have a meeting with him too when September 11th happened, and the other guy backed out of it finally, and they gave me Dan. And so what Dan inherited a disgruntled, grieving, you know, angry author whose book's publication had been delayed for a year because his editor had been ill. And the way he handled it, he was so graciously tentative and respectful, and even when he had to insist on his own pass, he couldn't just publish this book without knowing what was in it. And then, having read it, had ideas and had to broach them to me.
Good.
He just handled it beautifully, and his ideas, the things that he had to say, made so much sense. I would say about 60 to 70% of the time, stuff that he suggested, either cuts or things that I should flesh out a little, were absolutely spot on.
Wow, that's a very high percentage for such an intricate novel as Hello to the Cannibals. Please stay tuned to the KC Kowar Show, A Celebration of Words. We'll be right back with Richard Bausch. Welcome back to the KC Kowar Show, A Celebration of Words. We're lucky today to have as our guest Richard Bausch, the author of Wives and Lovers, The Stories of Richard Bausch, Hello to the Cannibals, and all of the other titles, I believe, are available in trade paperback. Who's the publisher of the trade paperbacks?
Perennial.
They're doing all of them. Mm-hmm. God bless them. So we're going to shift gears here a little bit because we have the rare opportunity to talk to someone who actually writes novels and short stories with equal grace. And a lot of novelists write short stories, but they do it kind of as a rite of passage to becoming a novelist, and then other short story writers try novels and they never fly. So it's very difficult to wear the hat of a novelist and a short story writer, I think, in a very meaningful sense. And one of my favorite short story writers, as any listener of this show knows, is André Debus, who I think was a modern master of the short story form. Mr. Bausch knew André, and in 1996, when Dancing After Hours was published, Mr. Bausch reviewed the collection in André's collection of stories. And I'm just going to read two of the paragraphs. He says, "In the title story, one of the most gracious and exquisite works of fiction I've ever read, a small group of people in a neighborhood bar in a town somewhere in Massachusetts move from separate and even alienated realities toward friendship and love and understanding. And they do so credibly without an ounce of sentimentality in a prose that is perfectly wrought, constructed with an intensity and art and an artistry that no novelist, even if he is a great one, ought to try if he is not willing to give the form its just amount of awe. I said that the title story is gracious. In fact, it seems to me that this whole collection is suffused with grace, bathed in a kind of spiritual glow. Mr. Debus's characters are people we more than feel for. We end up cheering for them, often because they are courageous or simply plain stubborn, but most of all because they refuse to despair. My job, one of them says about her own failure, is to try and to be vigilant and keep hoping. That could be the line on which the entire book stands. We do not talk much about beauty these days in literary criticism, and I think it's high time we started doing so. André Debus's Dancing After Hours is beautiful." And when I read that, I had been corresponding with André since 1985 through his accident, and I was so happy that Dancing After Hours received the acclaim published by Knopf and gave André the freedom to live his life, though it ended in 1999, with some recognition of what was undoubtedly is already now being, people are discovering the genius that André Debus had. Mm-hmm. And as happens all too often, André is not here physically to experience the, but that was never important to André Debus. He did not care whether he made money or...
I think if you're really serious about this arduous but blessed occupation, I don't think you can ever worry too much about that stuff. I try not to get the students to think when I talk to students about that stuff. It is, you know, you're never going to know anyway what the final judgment is, so you just try to be as faithful as you can to the truth as you can perceive it or as it makes itself available to you in the work, and do your job. Show up for work in the mornings, you know.
André wrote me once that if we worry about who will publish our work, we lose hope to an abstraction. And I think sometimes writers who are learning their craft, and even people who have been writing for a while, there's kind of an obsessive with getting obsession with being published. And I think that if we look at Andre Debus, we learn that if that is your primary motivation to see your work in print, or to have the illusion that you're going to make a living, a living off of writing stories, that's probably not the best way to approach the craft, and one ought to come at it from more of a love of literature and reading.
That's what George Garrett said. You take up writing for a lifetime, not for a living. You know, and the great thing about it is there's no cutoff. You can work until the day you die. And I love to tell a story about the House of Burgesses in Virginia during the 18th century. And before Virginia became Virginia, it was just a colony then. It was before the Revolution. There was a terrible thunderstorm that came up, and it came coincidentally and coinciding with a total eclipse of the sun that nobody expected or knew was coming. So it just got black as night in midday. And a member stood up and said, "I think it's the end of the world and we should adjourn." And a second member stood up and said, "If it's not the end of the world, there's no reason to adjourn. And if it is the end of the world, I want to be found doing my work." Now, I've always thought that was the way to live your life, just to do your work, do what you're supposed to do, you know, fulfill the terms of the contract, and then forget about it. You can't really worry about what the world will do with it. You just can't. You just got to just do it and let it go.
Mm-hmm. Jim Harrison, who's an author I admire, I remember when he wrote a novel called Dalva, and which is one of my favorites, and the New York Times Book Review reviewed it and said, and gave it kind of a lukewarm review, which always just drives me crazy when I read a novel which is just so awesome. And he wrote me and he said, there's more danger in reading bad reviews than good ones. Oh, excuse me, there's more danger in reading good reviews than bad ones. And at this point in my life, there's a vast accretion of scar tissue and I'm not really bothered by it. And I think as a story writer, you have to have really thick skin in terms of what people are going to say about the stories that you write. And
well, I quit reading them. I don't read reviews precisely for that reason.
I don't blame you.
The good ones are just as dangerous, if not more so, than the bad ones. The bad ones you can get angry at and argue with, but the good ones are scary because, I mean, you want them. You want what we call selling reviews, although I don't think good reviews sell books. The single most, in my lifetime, most biggest bestseller in my life, certainly, is also the most pilloried and ridiculed book anybody published in my life, and that's Bridges of Madison County. The reviews were just, you know, they were laughing at it. And, you know, it was on the bestseller list for something like 5 years.
Yeah.
So I don't know that reviews do much except to keep the level of respect up in the houses, the publishing houses.
Mm-hmm.
And do a thing that does form a kind of accretion, and that is reputation. That if you have a long period of time where you're getting good reviews and you seem consistently to get them, that this reputation builds among readers, so that they're more likely to not necessarily buy the book, but say your name anyway.
Right.
And,
right.
But I don't know. I agree with that. I don't read them. I don't want anything to do with them. I try not to even look at the jacket blurbs because they're, you know, they're.
I had to read the one from Richard Ford because it was just so good.
I know that one. That's all right. I knew that one. Richard's an old friend.
Yeah.
We met through each other's work, through liking each other's work.
Oh, good. Good.
So, yeah.
I'm sure.
Which is often the case. You know, people say, "Oh, well, it's just a blurb from a friend," but in fact, these people are friends because of this work, and they read it and like it, and they become friends because they have great respect for the artistry they find in the other person's work.
And as a reader, I can tell when an author has read the book that the blurb is associated with them, when they have not. Most times, after I finish the book, and if blurbs on dust jackets are accurate, there are some writers that are very prolific that must read a novel a day, and that I find kind of mind-bending, that someone could really write all day and promote books and read 400 books a year, but some people do it, I guess. And but it's kind of an art of getting blurbs. I've had people call me and say, Casey, do you know someone who will review this book? And you know, I'm looking for so-and-so.
Yeah.
And I always say, well, you know, I'm sorry, I would never ask another writer to read a book and endorse it. They get too many galleys and uncorrected proofs as it is. So
I tell my publisher, and he's been doing it since Hello to the Cannibals. He has a list of names and stuff, and he has to construct a letter that says, Richard Bausch does not know who I'm asking, so that you're free to say no. He will never know whether or not I asked you or whether or not you said yes or no, so that everybody's free, even close pals, to say, no, I don't want to do it this time. I'm too busy. I can't get to it. Or I didn't like it.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's generally, you know, when you like a writer's work, you kind of end up liking. I mean, in fact, I know Jill McCorkle through her work. I didn't know her personally at all. I didn't know her from Adam's House Cat. George Garrett gave me The 7th of July.
Wonderful novel.
And I just loved it. And
yeah.
So I had this great respect for her as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
Then when I got to meet her in Chattanooga about 12 years ago, you know, and saw how charming she was and how much fun she was to be with, we became really good pals. But it was the work first, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always the case with me.
Yeah. Stay tuned to the Casey Kowar Show, A Celebration of Words. We'll be right back with one more section with Mr. Bausch. Please stay tuned.
Okay, I'm going to read, if I can find it, a little note that Mary...
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
Got it.
Okay, it's very, very short.
Take as long as you like. It's not time
it's
constraint.
Like here. And then I'll read a little bit down to here, maybe.
Okay.
Okay?
That's great. Welcome back to the Casey Kowar Show, A Celebration of Words. Our guest today has been Richard Bausch. And one of the goals of this show is to let the readers and the writers of the show listen to the author read their work aloud, which I think oftentimes is a revelation to people because we spend a lot of time reading books. But to actually hear an author read their work is, a lot of times, it's really what can turn someone on to a writer, I think, particularly in poetry as well. So we're going to end today's show with Richard Bausch reading an excerpt from Hello to the Cannibals.
You know, when I went to Australia, I realized nobody had ever heard my voice. Nobody knew me from anything, and I was so tempted to get off that plane to be somebody entirely other, you know, like just for the whole 2 days I was in one place, be Yosemite Sam, you know.
So let's get on with the writing.
You know, just see what they do. Anyway, one of the things that happens in the novel is that Lily writes these journal entries that are actually like letters back to Mary, because Mary kept a journal, which is fictitious. I made up Mary's journal, but addressed to anyone in the future. And Lily has taken it to mean her, so there's this sort of correspondence across time. Mostly in Lily's mind, of course. And this is a journal entry of Lily's addressed to Mary. She's in New Orleans now, living with Dominic, her friend, her gay friend, and Manny, her gay friend's lover, and her gay friend's lover's great aunt, Violet. Night alone. I've been working on the play about you and arguing with Aunt Violet, who says perhaps it is on some level possible to explain you as an exaggerated case of sexual hysteria. I think you would laugh at this. I have pointed out your early childhood interest in explorers and exploring, and in the study of human spiritual beliefs. I reminded her of your private study of Spinoza and Goethe, of your pantheism, your lifelong curiosity about the manifestations of human faith and the definitive questions of the meaning of things. I have spoken to her of your lineage and of the example of your father. She nods and gives me a tolerant smile and then mentions the fact that at the turn of the century, it was considered neurotic for a woman to experience or wish to experience orgasm, and that in such a climate, an extraordinary, healthy, passionate intelligence, if it felt the pressure to break out, would either self-destruct or run. She says you ran. She's perfectly admiring of you in saying it, and talks about your toughness and valor, though she insists that valor doesn't depend on events or extraordinary people for its presence in the world. Extraordinary people only serve as the dazzling illustrations of it over time. For most women, it was brave enough to raise their families and bear their crushed passions in secret. She confesses that at some level she's describing her own experience, but she can't be moved in her distinctions concerning yours. I have to go to work. I'm a teacher now. And that's the end of the journal entry, and then there's this. The heat of September and October gave way to a softer kind of warmth, the breath of the Cerulean Gulf. Hurricane season had come and gone. Storms washed in from the sea, but nothing worse than a squall, a few somber days of rain. She taught classes and came back to the house to care for Mary. In the late afternoon, she sat out on the veranda in the barbed shade of the palm plants and wrote. Sometimes she simply watched the traffic on the street and what she could see of the lime-colored river between the houses on the other side. There were many nights when, sleepless, she sat out there as if presiding over the restless and always agitating city with its cries and hubbub and songs, its continual uproar of human voices. Dominic brought her books from the store, and in the mornings, Manny always had coffee for her. Aunt Violet found things to do away from the house, though it was growing more complicated for her to get around. She had friends in various homes, private and institutional. When she walked, her pace was quick or looked in some way hurried, even if she took it more slowly. And it was true that on the infrequent occasions Lily accompanied her, Lily had some trouble keeping up. Violet was fond of walking to the river to sit on a bench and watch the traffic gliding along there. She would talk about the history of it all, the big steamboats that had plied the old man north, and the terrible floods of the Mississippi Delta back in the 20s and 30s. She liked to think about how the muddy-looking water came all the way from Minnesota, down the curve of the planet, stretching that far, dividing the continent. Think of it, Cher. You're looking at water that washed out of Lake Itasca in northern Minnesota. It's like looking at me and realizing you're looking at the 19th century. Well, the last year of it, anyway. She smiled wryly. I'm old as the river and I'll never die. Don't I sound like a fictional character, the wise old lady from the novel about the wise old lady? Lily watched her stare out at the smoothly coursing water. The deeply lined face was far more interesting than the muddy flow along the banks. Lily only wanted her to go on talking, but then Violet would nod and close her eyes, breathing so shallowly that it was difficult to tell if she was breathing at all. If the younger woman touched her shoulder, she'd stir and give a chiding glance. Not yet, Cher. I'm still here. I wish you'd stop talking like that, Lily said.
Beautiful. Thank you, Mr. Bausch, for joining us on the Casey Coar Show, A Celebration of Words. I really appreciate your time. And I hope you enjoyed the interview, and I look forward to our listeners buying your books and reading them.
I do, too. I hope they will.
Thank you.